Blog Talk Radio.
What's going on, everybody? It is I, William Powell, internationally known, nationally respected, and locally appreciated. Welcome to another episode of Inside Acting, where we bring entertaining to entertainment. Tonight, we're going to be talking with comedy horror meister, director Michael Marino. But before we talk to Michael, let me tell you what I've been up to the past week. I had a very successful workshop, Networking Tricks for Actors in Tacoma Park, Maryland. I teach a lot of concepts in that workshop that will blow your mind. So if you want to step up your audition opportunities, go to www.performingartsstudio.com. That's www.performingartsstudio.com. Go on there and sign up. Let's move on to some celebrity news. I see here that Sean Diddy Combs has plans to launch a new music-themed cable network called Revolt, with a projected launch date later this year on December 12, 2012. The channel is described as a music news network with an urban skew that will aim at African Americans. Distribution has already been secured via Comcast and apparently through Time Warner Cable. Got a couple of job listings here. Now I see up here in New York City, a conflict daytime talk show is in search of an associate producer. Must have experience booking conflict resolution stories. 3+ years experience of booking real people for talk shows. And you need to send your resume in to them at televisiontalkjob@gmail.com. That's televisiontalkjob@gmail.com. Down in Atlanta, I see Fox is looking for a manager of social media to create and implement social media and communication strategy. What's needed there is a BS and a BA in communication. They're looking for a minimum of 5 to 7 years experience, PR or marketing. And to apply there, all you need to do is go to www.foxcareers.com. And back up in the Big Apple again, NBC Sports is looking for a marketing manager. They want somebody that can work with key NBC Sports stakeholders to market and increase sales of properties of NBC Sports and NBC Sports Network. 5 years experience. They want you to apply at www.nbcunicareers.com. Okay, so I see that Michael Marino has joined us. Hey, Mike, what's up, man?
William, how are you?
Excellent, excellent. How you feeling, man?
I'm doing okay. You know, just doing the life, living the life, as I say. How about yourself?
That's good. That's fantastic. That's fantastic, man. I know. You know, since I've known you, I've known you as mostly a horror guy. I think of you as the horror meister. How would you describe yourself as the director?
Well, first off, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. It's good to talk with you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I would say, you know, a horror master or a horror meister, you know, it's kind of like a partial, you know, aspect of my filmmaking career. It's not all of it. Ideally, I'd like to make in James Bond films, but, you know, who wouldn't?
Right, of course.
Yeah. It'd be fun to blow something up, you know? I think we never stop being 12. We just want to blow things up.
I agree with that.
So the horror film kind of comes close because you get to do things you can't normally do in day-to-day life and get away with it and excuse yourself as saying, oh, no, it's a horror film. It's okay.
Right. So you have that dramatic license.
Yeah, you get a lot of dramatic license, and as long as you've got actors who are willing and able and open-minded, you're halfway home.
That's right. Yeah, it's all in the audience. I mean, not everybody likes horror films. I mean, you go back and look at Evil Dead films and some of the films back in the day. Some of the best ones that I like, there's an element of comedy. There's a little bit of strand of comedy there, you know?
I think so. I mean, if you take some of these horror films that have come out in the last 8 to 10 years, it seems like a lot of the ones that are very popular have been a very graphic and very misogynistic. And, you know, I'm with you. I kind of like films that tend to be a little more, yes, it's scary, yes, it's suspense, but at the same time, you know, you can have fun, you know, and laughing at a ridiculous situation or even kind of maybe even over-the-top situation that's a little bit gory, you know, because it's kind of ridiculous and over-the-top, makes it a lot more fun. So,
yeah.
You know, Evil Dead, those kind of movies are a lot of fun, because especially the second Evil Dead when the skeletons are marching across the field. I mean, that killed me. You know, I love that part. So, I tend to go for a little softer, you know. Well, you saw the film. It's more tongue-in-cheek. It's not a comedy. It's a horror film that happens to have comedic elements, you know.
Exactly.
Or a supernatural film, you know.
I had the honor of writing a review of Pearson Place, and of course, you know, you saw me at the premiere, and one of the things that I really liked about the sitting there watching that was just like, it was just so far out. I mean, I remember, I'm a quote by review here, I've got it in front of me. I mean, we see a whacked out chick in a bathtub, mannequins that talk, a hand coming from under the bed and such like, all punctuated by laughs, Hitler and yawn. I mean, it was that kind of movie.
Yeah, that's just basically my daily life. I mean, you know. that's what I see every morning when
Backed
I get up.
Out chicks and bathtubs and pants from under the bed.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's rent control, so you got to take what you can get. So, yeah, if you have to have fun with these things, I mean, it's hard enough to make a movie, and you don't want to take yourself too seriously because, you know, he spent a lot of time, and he took us 3 years to make this film. And, you know, we're still working on it. We're still trying to get it out there in the world. And
Well, talk about that. Talk about distribution. I mean, that's the thing a lot of filmmakers overlook, distribution. How's that going for you?
Distribution, that's one of the things you start doing when you start, you know, writing. And you got to start looking into that right away, because you got to see what distributors are looking for, what product. The problem is, by the time you finish your movie, they've already moved on from that particular business model. They're already moved on. So, you know, what was popular 3 years ago may not be popular today, you know? So you never know what you're going to – so you can't worry about that too much. You just got to go with what you feel is something that comes from your heart and your soul, and, you know, make a movie that you really, really, really want to make. And hopefully the audience will be there, because, you know, what was popular – 5 years ago, you know, won't be popular 5 years from now. And, you know, most movies from Hollywood, when you see it on a screen, that started 5, 7, even 9 years ago, you know, the process. So that's why you see a lot of these movies that, you know, all of a sudden all these movies that take place in, you know, Troy or Greece come out, and all these movies come out that suddenly are like Harry Potter type films, because, you know, like anybody else, the studios want to make money, so they're going to copy one another, and whatever's popular at the time is what they're going to make. So we're trying to get it out on video on demand. That process is a little bit lengthy. You know, there's kind of a grading system. You get an aggregator, and they're an agent for you, and then they basically contact all the different outlets. You know, anybody from iTunes to, you know, Comcast to Cox, and they watch the films to make sure, you know, it's something they can put up on their screens. You know, and,
right.
You know, not so it's not porn or some, you know, crazy movie, you know. And so, you sort of have to get it approved. But what's great about video on demand is you have upwards of, you know, 45 million homes that your film could be seen in. So it's a great it's like the new art house, really. You know, instead of worrying about whether your film's playing in, you know, Chicago or New York or L.A., you just get it on video on demand. And somebody says to me, where can I watch it? And I say, pretty much anywhere, you know. If you've got cable, you've got our movie. You just gotta.
Wow.
So it's a great way for independent filmmakers to get their movies out there. It's just a time consuming process. It takes some time to get it out there, you know?
Yeah, but it sounds like it'd be worth the wait.
But yeah, I mean,
back up a little bit and go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, you got to think, I think you have to look at it one of two ways. You want to make a good movie and take your time, or you want to make a fast movie. You know, it's like, you know, what you put into it is what you should get back out of it. If you make it quickly and cheaply, you're going to get back probably not as much as you thought you would. But,
right,
of course, there are lots of, I mean, if you're Roger Corman, it's different. You've got it in place. You can make, you know, Sharkeropolis or whatever they are, you know, Octa Crab or something, you know.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah. Those things,
you know,
those
sci-fi
science fiction. Right.
Yeah, they make those things fairly quickly, and they're fun to watch. But, you know, if that's what you want to make. And we're looking to make something like that maybe, you know, down the road here.
Those are more fun when they put, like, celebrities in them. They had that movie, Mars Attacks, about 15, 16 years ago. They put all these washed-up movie stars in
there. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah,
it's fun when it's, like, familiar faces, you know, and they get zapped by aliens or whatever the thing is.
Yeah, you get some actors that have been around for a while, and you put them in cameo roles.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, but for guys like, you know, us, you know, independent film guys, that's still a big budget film. I mean, you're talking six-figure paychecks for the actors alone, you know. So
wow.
It's not easy to get an actor like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
So let's back up and talk about casting.
Okay.
A lot of my listeners are going to be interested in that. You're a director, so what do you look for when you're casting?
Well, generally, you know, it's on a project by project basis, obviously. So if you know, a really broad brush answer to that would be, you know, I like to have actors that I work with that have a significant amount of theater experience, simply because to me that sort of states that they are dedicated. You know, theater is a very, very difficult medium, and if you're a theater actor, you have to really, really commit yourself 100% to it. So it also teaches you discipline as an actor. Film acting is a very different monster, if you will.
Right.
But then when you get them on set, you got to get the theater out of them. You know what I mean? So,
right.
But you got something to work with. I mean, I'd rather have an actor who overacts than underacts, because you can always rein him in. But it's hard to get somebody to come out of their shell. That's a lot more work.
I went on an audition not too long ago, and I ran into that. I mean, the guy behind the camera's like, don't yell at me.
I mean, yeah, well, you know.
Yeah, so
depends on what you want.
You're used to theater.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, I sort of see it the other way. You know, I'd rather have an actor who's willing to, you know, open himself up and make himself appear to be bad than somebody who's, like, whisper. I've had actors come in for auditions, and I'm 5 feet away, and I can't hear them, you know?
Wow.
You know, I want somebody to chew up the scenery, you know? So they got to be able to chew up the scenery, because you can always get an actor to kind of, like I said, pull it back. But, you know, getting an actor to come out of his shell or her shell is a little more difficult. And it becomes a time issue. You know, as you know, being on a film set, the enemy is always time. So it gets expensive when you start having to deal with an actor who's just not comfortable being in front of, you know, a group of people. That's why the theater actors tend to be so good, because they're used to working the wire. You know, they're right on the razor's edge all the time. You know, when they go out on the stage for the theater performance, they don't get a second take, you know. So when you get them on a set, they're a little more focused. And I'm generalizing here because you asked me kind of a broad question, but that's more or less what it is.
Yeah. That leads me to my next question is, how many takes do you like to do?
You know, honestly, I'm kind of like I'm of the Clint Eastwood school. Two, three max.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and unless there's a technical issue, you know, the actor's got it. I'm not a heavy-handed director. You know, if I put you on a set and you have a role, I'm not going to tell you what to do unless you're doing it wrong for whatever reason.
And you delegate.
Yeah, I delegate. I mean, it's like if you hire a guy to build a brick wall in front of your house, you're not out there throwing the mortar on the brick. I mean, he knows what he's doing. That's why you hired him.
Exactly.
Otherwise, I'd do it myself. And,
right.
You know, I have a lot of respect for actors. I started as an actor, and I realized very quickly that it's not for me. So I understand what actors go through, you know.
Why was it not for you? Let's go back, because I know you have a very interesting bio. I mean, you've traveled around the world. You've done all these different things. But I know you started out, you tried out as an actor in L.A. So tell me about
right.
that and why you found that acting wasn't for you.
Well, I just felt, I'll tell you what I think is really, really, what was really hard for me was, and this is why I understand how actors can have a difficult time. You know, all that downtime between setups and scenes,
mm-hmm.
I just wasn't good at it. You know, my brain just started, I have to be doing something, you know. I'm the kind of person who's watching television and has the music playing, you know, that kind of thing. I like to have my mind kind of going all the time. So the downtime that you guys have to deal with in between setups and you know, reshoots or whatever, it's just too much. You know, it just isn't for me. And I like kind of being, you know, I guess maybe because, you know, I had so many jobs. I did a lot of blue-collar work, you know, like construction, you know, tending bar. I like building and creating things. So I like to just be around the crew and moving stuff around. Even if I'm just moving, like, a chair from one spot to another, it makes me feel like I just did something, you know? So for actors, it's like you guys have to sit and wait for the crew who's there, you know, to make you guys sound and look great. But I couldn't deal with all that, you know, just downtime. It was just killing me. Plus, I didn't like being cold too. You know, so I was like, I got a better idea, you know. So it just feels more natural for me, and I think it's out of respect to actors. You know, if you're not an actor, you should just let the actors be the actors. And you know, some people are better at it than others. That's all there is to it. You just have a more natural inclination towards it. And I think
Well, some people do both.
Some people do both, and I have had to do both, and you know, I enjoy it. You know, in my fantasy land world, I would love to have been Charlie Sheen on Two and a Half Men, because talk about a fun job, you know. So,
who wouldn't?
You know, who wouldn't, exactly? But that's one guy, right? So, I do get a little jealous when I see you guys, you know. Actors get to dress up like cowboys or, you know, SWAT guys. You know, you get to be a kid, you know, and that's fun. So I get a little jealous about that sometimes, envious. So, you know, when I have a film that, you know, has like four or five extras, I'll be like cop number nine, you know, just so I can just get my actor on a little bit. You know,
there you go.
Or I'll be the pizza delivery guy, you know, that kind of thing. So I get a little bit of that here and again when I get a chance. But professionally, you know, pursuing it on a day-to-day basis, like, most actors that we know, no way. I give you guys a lot of credit for that, because that's a tough, tough road.
Yeah, that puts me in mind of a play I did several years ago. The director he gave himself basically a role with like two lines. He told me, William, he said, that's all I can handle.
That's about right.
Yeah.
And then you have the other directors who always put themselves in the main, you know, they put themselves as the star. And they seem to have all the love scenes. You always kind of find those guys a little peculiar, too, you know?
Yeah, I've heard stories. about that.
You know, those guys. Like, wait a minute, that guy's the director, and he wrote all the love scenes are with him and all the single girls? What's going on here? This is something creepy going on here.
Very, very odd.
Yeah, there's something else
going
on with that one.
So now you went to Rockport International Film School, Corcoran School of Art, and then you founded your film company in '98. Talk about that process of transitioning over.
Well, after I came back, I was living in L.A. I'd been traveling, and I was in L.A., and I was, you know, trying to be an actor. And I thought, well, this isn't really for me. And just by happenstance, a friend of mine called me from D.C., who worked at a public access station in Rockville, Maryland.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking on the phone, and he said, well, are you coming back to D.C.? I said, yeah, I'll be coming back for, you know, the holiday season, you know, Christmas, Thanksgiving. And he said, you know, there's a public access station here that they need producers. All you got to do is take their course, and they certify you, you know, like a lot of them do. And I was telling my boss, you know, my boss was saying, do you know anybody we could get in here for associate producers? We just need somebody who'll talk to anything, or, you know, talk to a tree. And he goes, I'll talk to you right away. And I said, because you'll talk to anybody, because, you know, I talk a lot. You know, I'll talk your ear off, you know that. And so I came back here, and I took the course, and it was like the skies parted.
Wow.
I found my home. I was like, okay, this is what I was put on this earth to do. I knew it without a second thought. That's when I went to Rockport. and took some more courses there in filmmaking. And actually studied as a line producer.
Okay.
That's how I got in, and that's when I decided to start my own company. And, you know, it's just been brick by brick ever since then. And every year, you know, it gets a little bigger, a little stronger, a little deeper, you know. And so it's been a process, but it takes time, you know. You're not going to become a rock star overnight, as they say.
Exactly. Yeah, like the Beatles. I mean, they spent all those years over in Germany just playing the small clubs, and you keep working and you keep working. And one day you turn around and, you know, you have something great.
And you're there. Yeah, I kind of got away from it for about 4 years, though.
Okay.
I went off. I thought I was going to, you know, I was like, this is great. I love it. But, you know, I got to make a living, too. So I started freelancing. I started freelancing as a news producer. I worked Capitol Hill for a little while, just doing, you know, stuff for MSNBC and Reuters. And I was tending bar at night, you know, just kind of doing the thing, working the Hill. And, you know, they need B-roll of the Capitol, you know, that kind of stuff. So I got away from it for about four and a half years, I guess, and then I just said, "This is miserable. I mean, if I'm gonna record fantasy, you know, watching congressmen and senators talk, I might as well do the real thing." So I decided to get back into it. Yeah, I mean, it was pathetic.
Wow.
I can't tell you how many times I heard the same speech from different guys. It was like, you got to be kidding me.
Woo.
Like handing them over to each other. So
Woo.
It was
okay.
Yeah. So, which is interesting now, considering that I'm two blocks from the Capitol right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay, I'm not going to touch that one. Moving right along, let's talk about 502.
What are all those police lights outside?
What's that?
What are all those police lights outside of my house?
Uh-oh. Look out. It's election season.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got one of your first films. Talk about 502. How did that come about?
502 actually is a pared-down version, or pared-down version of The Haunting of Pearson Place.
Oh, okay.
I wrote The Haunting of Pearson Place, but I couldn't get the budget for Pearson Place. So what I decided to do was just take the character that Regan Wilson plays, Michael,
mm-hmm.
and put him in an apartment 502, and I changed it a little bit. I made him a writer. I gave him a different name. And he basically is a writer who's doing writing a book on a serial killer, kind of a Jeffrey Dahmer type.
Oh, okay.
And he's got writer's block. And he, you know, of course, in his infinite wisdom, decides that the best way to kind of get inside the killer's head is to move into his apartment. You know, that's now vacant because the cops have caught the guy already and he's off in jail. So
right.
Reagan's character moves into the apartment, 502, and the demons and ghosts of 502 essentially start haunting him. And the entire film takes place with the exception of one scene in a two-bedroom apartment.
Wow.
And it was a you know, it basically came out of Pearson Place, the first draft of Pearson Place, which originally was called The House. And I realized, okay, I'm not going to get this kind of money, so how can I take some of those elements and use what I have available to me? I had a two-bedroom apartment available to me. You know, we painted it, like, really dingy colors and, you know, with the lighting and everything, made it look a lot more run down and worn out, and we just shot the entire film, again, with the exception of one scene in the apartment. And that was an interesting shoot, you know, crew. 15 to 20 and, you know, no more than three actors at a time, you know, crammed in 12 to 14 hours a day, especially a small bathroom, because we had a few scenes in, you know, some of these tight apartment bathrooms, which was always fun.
Getting back to actors, talk a little bit about the audition process. How do you handle that?
I have sort of an unusual audition process. I don't really do, like, cattle calls.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally I'll put out notices because I'm looking to, you know, looking for specific actors. But generally what I do is I meet actors like yourself, you know, at receptions or parties or just here and there. And I get a sort of, and I put them in my, you know, my mental bank. And I think to myself when I'm writing or when I come across a script, who I think would fit that role. And then essentially what I do is I have a sense of somebody. I go with my instinct. And I kind of do what Richard Attenborough did, you know, in England when he was shooting out in England, you know, 50, 60 years ago. I meet people for coffee or a beer and hang out with them for a couple hours. And if I like them for a couple hours, I'm like, okay, the role's yours. And that's pretty much how most of the cast, you know, obviously Ken Arnold. Ken never read for me a day in his life, and neither did Tracy McGee. Yeah. I just had lunch with him, you know, and we hung out. And I said, okay, I can work with these people. I think these people will be perfect for the role. You know, I have done casting calls, but they're very specific. You know, I'll ask people to send me headshots, and then I'll invite them to the casting call, you know, in a month or whatever down the road. But generally, my process has turned into, hey, let's have coffee and, you know, talk. And that's pretty much it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's real high tech.
I could tell. Very high tech.
I mean, you know, I think, Wayne, what it is you know, you can sort of get a sense of a person, and if you're paying attention and listening to them, you know, traveling around the world, I was very lucky to do that for quite a few years. And a heavy tended bar around the world as well, you start to learn really quickly how to read people, because that's how you survive. That's how you make your dollar.
No, oh, yeah.
You got to know who's in front of you, like, within 30 seconds, because that's going to make the difference between you making a dollar or not making a dollar. So you can meet somebody and generally pick up their vibe if you're looking at them correctly. If you're not just sort of, you know, most of us go, hi, how are you? It's nice to meet you. Oh, nice to meet you, too. And they'll kind of gloss over it. But, you know, if you really watch them and listen to them and, you know, acknowledge what they're saying, you can learn a lot about a person in the first 2 minutes of a conversation very quickly. So, yeah, you just have to be looking for it, you know. And I always try to think of the person and the role being the same. You know, I don't try to squeeze, you know, a square peg.
A round peg into a square hole,
yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So why. You know, you're not going to hire Schwarzenegger to play a ballerina. You know what I mean? So, you know, people have certain things that they expect to see on film. And, you know, as much as I would love to be a little more of a rebel in that area, you know, when you're trying to make a living at this, sometimes you got to go with a sort of cliche. And that doesn't hurt, you know. And I also, I think you probably maybe know this or maybe you don't. I generally work with the same sort of core group of actors. They're sort of my, you know, troupe of actors. And on each project, I'd say 60% of the actors, 70% of the actors I've worked with before. And then I bring in a good 20 to 30% or so new actors in smaller roles and see how they work out. And then if they seem to be the kind of people I want to work with, then they'll come along to the next film, you know. Because
I wasn't aware of that. Michael,
yeah.
It's been a pleasure, man. I got to wrap this show up. We're getting real short on time, man. Thank you so much for coming on, man.
Hey, anytime, man. And thank you for the wonderful review. And I really, really appreciate the opportunity. And I enjoyed it. It was the fastest 30 minutes I think I've ever had since I got out of jail.
You know? Okay, man. I'll be talking to you again. Okay,
all right,
good
take
night.
Care. Thanks a lot. Thank
all
you.
Right. Bye-bye. And we thank all our listeners out there for tuning in. Don't forget to look for my workshop, Networking Tricks for Actors. The next one's going to be Monday night, February 6th from 7:45 to 8:45. The cost is $25. Go to performingartstrainingstudio.com. And check out my column, DC Actors Examiner, most easily found by Googling DC Actors Examiner. I'll be teaching along with actor Ron Bush, Understanding the Acting Business in the DMV, February 18th from 11 to 2, 3500 Boston Street, suite number 412 in Baltimore, Maryland. The cost is $100. Also, assisted directing Crimes of the Heart at Bowie Playhouse. Go to pglt.org. to find out about that, www.pglt.org. And this is William Powell encouraging all my fellow thespians out there to do something for your career every day and break a leg.